From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Amazon series Transparent says goodbye with a musical farewell and without its original star, Jeffrey Tambor. Creator Jill Soloway takes time to reflect on the show's legacy.
I think there was a moment that I really kind of got it, where, oh, Jeffrey Tambor playing a trans woman is dangerous in a way for trans women. They were being thought of as men dressing up as women. And so it was such a dangerous precedent.
And the next generation of film composers heads to Skywalker Ranch for some intensive training. All that coming up on The Frame. The Amazon series Transparent returns today for its final goodbye, a feature-length musical, or as creator Jill Soloway calls it, the musicale finale. The series centers on Maura Pfefferman, a trans woman who comes out late in life to her family, including three adult children. Not long after the most recent season premiered in 2017, Jeffrey Tambor, who played Maura, was accused of sexual harassment on and off set. He was fired from the show a couple of months later. I'm not giving anything away to say that the finale starts with the off-screen death of Maura. Soloway talked about the legacy of Transparent and the decision not only to end the show, but also to wrap it up with singing and dancing.
It was sort of a collective consciousness of, is there a reason to keep going when we don't have our main character? And yet at the same time, I didn't really want it to end on those terms, which are, you know, actor charged with sexual harassment, show dies, falls away. I couldn't have that be the ending of this thing that felt so much more celebratory. And in fact, I think even though some people will say, oh, you killed off Maura or you killed off Jeffrey Tambor, I really hate that way of talking about it because Maura herself is a really important trans woman. And because so many trans women's lives are devalued and so many trans women are at risk of murder just from walking down the street, we couldn't let that be the end. So we had to redo it on our own terms. We had to reclaim the space that was our show and really just reframe what we were doing there. And in doing so, we came up with this idea of taking this huge risk and using my sister's musical talent. And that's the Transparent musicale finale, or you could call it the musicale finale. It's up to you.
Your sister, Faith, is an executive producer on the show, and she wrote the songs. I'm going to start with the first one in the finale or finale?
Finale or finale.
Finale.
Or
this,
finale.
This one is called Sepulveda Boulevard.
I'm this close to a thing, and I think it's about to come true. Picking up the kids, the dry cleaning, and I'm heading to you.
It's a beautiful song, and anybody who's been stuck in traffic on Sepulveda Boulevard or any other road would recognize what that song is about. But it's also about not being able to approach the thing that you need to approach. And what is it about music that you can do as a storyteller that you can't say in dialogue?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people say when you're writing a musical or when you're working on a musical that at that moment that a character opens their mouth to sing, it has to be because there are no words. You know, it just gave us a new language. It gave us a new playground. And I love that we didn't just take songs and throw them at the movie, but instead Faith wrote them. And because Faith is my sibling, we grew up in the same family. We have the same sorts of boundary issues, the same feeling of, why do I feel so unseen when all I'm ever doing is trying to express myself? So that idea of, even, you know, how can I be home and feel so alone? I'm always just 5 miles away. It's, I don't know, I just start rocking out to it when I hear it because I'm so enamored of Faith's gift.
This episode also seems to be about a celebration of a life. And it deals with the mechanics of death in ways that we don't typically see. Like, what is it like to actually put a casket into an incinerator at a funeral home, which we don't typically see? But it is also about how you remember somebody and how you celebrate their life, even if their life hasn't been perfect.
Yeah, that scene of the cremation is the one that always gets me, and I always start crying when Ari pulls out the prayer book and starts to try to take this room that feels so kind of empty and banal with the mechanics of a cremation and turn it holy by speaking the Kaddish that she's just sort of learned how to do. And yeah, where we shot that at Hollywood Forever, we just kind of, as you can probably tell, like use the person who really does that.
I assume that's the real guy.
And we just said, you know, we filmed it like a documentary and we just said, you know, just do with us what you would do if a family wanted to be in the room.
And it's trying to make the clinical sacred in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does feel so clinical. And then as it's in some ways like a reason to be Jewish, you know, that we can all go through our lives without needing our Jewishness. But then sometimes there are moments where the only thing that we'll do is being able to say a prayer and a prayer that matters.
I want to ask you about the family that you created on screen. You and your sister Faith had done a stage show about the Bradys not that long ago. And I'm curious, and there's a reference to the Brady Bunch, a fleeting reference in this episode. What kind of influence did they have on you as a TV creator?
They had a huge influence on us. Faith and I were obsessed with the Brady Bunch. We were sort of like self, you know, taught Brady Bunch experts. And we loved it, I think, because of the way in which Mike and Carol held space for this, you know, this kind of chosen family in many ways, and this feeling of perfect that went kind of with that mid-century modern and the staircase and the red bricks and the promise, I think, of modernism to really give a clean slate to a really messy family. You know, Faith and I did a play called The Real Life Brady Bunch where, you know, pre-internet, I would sit a cassette recorder in front of the television, record the episode, put on headphones, transcribe it, and we would then work with actors to actually mount the Brady Bunch episode as important theater. And that was kind of our first big success as sisters. It went all around the country and also all around the world on tour. And then, yeah, in the transparent musicale finale, Ari Pfefferman, formerly known as Allie, goes into this kind of hole where they're really encountering that they are a show. You know, that is just this rabbit hole of this thing of like, well, wait, my family, I'm on a show that stars my family. And it kind of loops in and goes and gets the Brady Bunch as part of this fantasy. So, yeah, it kind of comes back for those who know.
Coming up on The Frame, more with Transparent creator Jill Soloway. Let's get back to my conversation with Jill Soloway, the creator of the series Transparent. The finale features a musical within a musical. It's how Shelley Pfefferman, played by Judith Light, processes not only the death of her ex, Maura, but also her changing relationship with her children. In the finale, Shelley casts actors as her kids in her musical, and her real children are not that happy about it.
You are not replaceable. Maura is not replaceable. My poor, sweet babies. You lost her. I didn't hold her. I didn't hold you.
Feelings. The feels.
There's a lot going on. In some ways, it might be the perfect summation of the series. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you were thinking about when you were writing that.
Really the same thing that I think Josh says to Raquel. Like, I've decided that I haven't been there for my people and I really want to show up for my people. And I think going on this journey with this family and processing so much on television with the art has made me really kind of return to that place of looking around and saying, who's my family? Who do I care about? In many ways, what Shelley does by recasting the family is what I did by recasting the family. And to just say you're not replaceable. To say we can't recast you. And also Shelley says, I didn't hold you, I held on to you.
Right.
And I think a lot of people want their parents to hold space for them rather than grab on, to encounter their children's needs with, I got you, instead of, you're making me anxious by needing things. So it's really about that universal longing for what we, I think, all want to hear our moms say.
Right. And it almost feels like it's you as a creator talking about these people that you've created, these characters that you've created who are living and breathing actors as well.
Yeah. They're actors, they're characters, they're doppelgangers, and then there's the doppelbangers. And, you know, there is that feeling in the show of the kind of House of Mirrors, Hall of Mirrors, you know, that we keep replicating. And yet at the end of this musical, Shelley says that essential thing, which is, no, it's you. You're my children. I love you.
I want to go back to the beginning of the show and actually coincided, oddly enough, with the beginning of The Frame. And you came on in September of 2014, and you were one of our very, very first guests. And here's a clip from that conversation.
Watching Girls, it was really angering for me at first, because I really had spent decades hiding unlikable, unattractive Jewish girls in likable, attractive, non-Jewish actors and characters, you know, really, really trying to tamp down the otherness of my experience so that I could sell it and so that I could monetize it. It made me so jealous. I was like, oh, all I ever had to do was nothing. You know, all I ever had to do was stop pretending.
That's such a great line, to stop pretending. And I think that's true, I think, in your life and in your creative work. When you think back about what you said then and how it's played out, what's your assessment?
Well, it's so funny. I was just thinking about Lena today. We've gotten to know each other since. And I was thinking actually about Phoebe Waller-Bridge and celebrating her night of Fleabag and celebrating, you know, winning 3 Emmys at once. And I was thinking about Lena and thinking, you know, that Phoebe wouldn't be there without Lena and I wouldn't be there without Lena. And I'll text her after this and tell her that and just remind her that what she did with her bravery and with Girls that allowed us to just kind of have a protagonist who was an unlikable, kind of dirty, kind of needy, kind of effed up chick. It really did change the game for all of us. Not just in television, you know, but you also look at the way the world has changed and the protagonists around Me Too and Time's Up and She Said, this way in which actually busting the status quo, busting the male gaze, busting man as subject, woman as object. There's such an explosion going on right now. It seems almost impossible to figure out how to hold on. Things are moving so quickly.
And yet sometimes they're not. I'm going to play something that you said when you won your Emmy for Outstanding Directing in a Comedy Series in 2015.
This TV show allows me to take my dreams about unlikable Jewish people, queer folk, trans folk, and make them the heroes. Thank you to the trans community for your lived lives. We need to stop violence against transgender women and topple the patriarchy. Topple the patriarchy!
Topple's an important word, isn't it? Isn't that the name of your production company?
Yes. Yes, it is. Topple the patriarchy. Topple.
That topple the patriarchy doesn't quite fit on a business card, but
right.
Topple does.
Yes, just topple.
But what did that moment mean for you? And what did that moment, in terms of what you said and what you've seen since?
I mean, sometimes I go, like, I hope I didn't start all this by saying that. And yet, who could have ever really imagined, you know, I was reading She Said yesterday. And, you know, for me, even finding a way to believe that getting the good favor of Harvey Weinstein would help me in some way. This idea that there's a male world where there's a certain way of behavior that gobbles up young women and turns them into, you know, meat to be just used and thrown away. And that as female creators, as female artists, we had to be really careful to not fall into that machine, yet know that it's there, yet try not to speak of it. We were kind of always doing this double Dutch dance, trying to find our way around masculine power and the ways that we're expected to, interact with masculine power if we're female and what happens when we stand up to it. And it was a very silent dance. And then suddenly everything changed. And now all of the women and gender nonconforming people, trans people, queer people are starting to kind of create a collective us where we're beginning, just slowly beginning to say, this is who we are and this is what we see and this is what we want.
We're talking with Jill Soloway, the creator of Transparent, which is ending with a big musical finale. How much did you try to practice what you preached and cast, as the show evolved, more trans actors to hire women or trans directors and writers, and to really make sure that everybody who was working on the show was comfortable being who they felt they were born to be?
Yeah, well, we kind of ended up sort of doing an upside down world, like a world that felt a little bit gender reversed, where it was more normal to be trans than cis in the world of Transparent. That if you came to work at Transparent, you would find everybody wearing a name tag that had their pronouns on it. You would find pronouns on call sheets. You would find bathrooms where everybody was comfortable to go anywhere. That we kind of took off the table the sorts of, you know, anxiety and paranoia that comes in the world if you're trans and you're moving through a cis normative world. So yeah, we did everything we could. I think there was a moment that I really kind of got it, where, oh, Jeffrey Tambor playing a trans woman is dangerous in a way for trans women. They were being thought of as men dressing up as women. And so it was such a dangerous precedent to have somebody that people knew as a man, Jeffrey Tambor, playing this character. At the same time, that's what made a lot of people watch. So there was something about his familiarity and, of course, his brilliance and his acting that was right at the time for Mora. But once we all kind of had our education and unfortunately had to have that education in public, you know, it was like, what can we do? We can just provide as many opportunities for trans people as possible.
This is a difficult hypothetical, but had you not made this show, do you think you would see yourself the way you see yourself today? Did it help you evolve in terms of understanding your identity?
Well, I definitely was around so many non-binary people that I started to go, oh, that really seems like a comfortable, relaxing place to be. It was more about letting go of the ways in which I indulged in self-hatred for not being a certain kind of woman, not being pretty enough or trying to kind of shape my power so that I felt cute instead, you know, just trying to not overwhelm people. And as soon as I took gender off of these ideas of myself, I just felt so much more comfortable. Like, okay, I have no gender anymore. I can be both genders. I can constantly switch. Meeting people who are non-binary, you know, definitely made me want to be more like them. But I just think, like, sometimes those time machine questions are so hard to answer because people say, like, would you have cast Jeffrey Tambor? And I just think, you know, I wish there were time machines, but there aren't time machines. So I find the time machine questions really, really hard to answer.
When people say goodbye to Transparent, when they watch the last moments of this final episode, what do you hope they're thinking about? And what are you thinking about?
Well, the last song is a sort of ode to joy, and everybody's wearing really bright colors, and we're all dancing on a hilltop together. And yeah, the legacy of, you know, we're going to get in trouble. I'm always going to get in trouble. I did something wrong. This kind of pain that we think of as a sort of specifically Jewish thing, but it really belongs to everybody. I hope that people, you know, feel the legacy of joy, family, chosen family, love, putting on a show, taking chances, and becoming ourselves.
So Transparent is gone, but 2 years ago, there was a showcase, Faith Soloway and Friends, Should Transparent Become a Musical? Is there an answer?
Yeah, well, hopefully soon we'll be able to put the word out, but we are heading into a theatrical exploration, and we like to say Transparent isn't ending, it's transitioning into a musical.
Perfect. Jill Soloway, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Transparent finale is streaming now on Amazon. Up next on The Frame, find out what the next generation of film composers are up to at George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch. So every year, a group of tomorrow's John Williamses and Hans Zimmers head up to Skywalker Ranch. The composers travel to Northern California for a lab that pairs them with indie directors for 2 weeks of intensive film composing collaboration. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving drove upstate for the last day of camp, and he has this report.
Skywalker Ranch, named for Luke Skywalker since it was built by his creative daddy, George Lucas, is a pastoral paradise just north of San Francisco. It's a state-of-the-art post-production facility where most major Hollywood movies get their final sound mixes.
This is the outgrowth of a frustrated architect that ends up with more money than he needs.
Is this a boy's idea of paradise?
In a way, it is. I need a rural environment in which to work. I get my best ideas being able to walk around and enjoy myself.
And for the past 7 years, it's a campground for the Sundance Institute Film Music and Sound Design Lab. The lab itself started more than 20 years ago when BMI, the performing rights organization with a clientele of famous film composers, teamed up with Robert Redford's Indie Incubator.
Redford and his people were starting this incredible film institute that was all about developing original voices and working to support, with a very inclusive agenda, all kinds of developing artists.
Doreen Ringer Ross is the vice president of film and media music at BMI.
Our platform became very akin to theirs, except it was all about music.
Alumni of the lab include Riverdale composer Sherry Chung and Green Book composer Chris Bowers. This year, eight composers were selected out of more than 700 applicants from all around the world. These are composers with some scores under their belts, with a career already on the runway, who see it as a chance to really take off.
I've actually always been an artist on just, you know, making my own music.
Asuka Matsumiya is a composer from Japan.
I got into film score music because one of my songs that I wrote was used as a theme song for a short film called I'm Here by Spike Jonze.
When I turn away.
Matsumiya was one of five women composer fellows this year. One of the lab's most obvious contributions is shaking up an overwhelmingly male field. Doreen Ringer Ross says that's intentional.
We tried to find as many women each time that were equally, you know, qualified that we could include. And over time, if you do some kind of affirmative action, you know, you can start to make a difference.
At the lab, each composer gets paired with a director who brings in a nearly finished indie film. Gia Rushidat, another fellow this year, hails from Jordan.
Actually living in the same space for like a week. If we have wine at night, we just like talk about the film. And if we wake up like at breakfast and have coffee, we talk about the film. And it's so much fun. I wish I could like live with my director for like 2 weeks or something before we start scoring.
One of the major takeaways here is teaching composers and directors who have one of the more unique collaborative tangos in filmmaking how to communicate. The director fellows had several industry pros drop in as creative advisors, including American Psycho director Mary Harron and Danish editor Jacob Schulsinger, whose credits include Force Majeure and Big Little Lies.
Most of the world, probably, but also especially the film business, is running really short on time and has the danger of working with fear, which is not good for creativity. So to create a place where directors can come with their movie and explore in a safe environment what sound and music can do to make their movie better is really unique, I think.
Composer fellows had drop-ins from several A-list advisors, including James Newton Howard and Marco Beltrami. That made all the difference for Ozzie Cargyle from Detroit.
They're sharing stories about how they met their directors, how they survived, you know, a crisis of a production. And this really sort of open, transparent sharing of their experiences that, for lack of a better word, humanizes this highly celebrated art form and makes you feel like, okay, if they had their struggles and their challenges, but they made it to where they are, I can do the same thing.
Over the 2 weeks, each composer scored one scene from the film of their paired director. On the last day, a chamber orchestra recorded the music on Skywalker's scoring stage. This is Ozzie Cargyle's score for The Hunt, a documentary about truffle hunters and their dogs. Cargyle says an unexpected bonus of the lab was meeting an alumnus who now works as its technical director.
Jean-Luc Bontemps. I was a black composer. Meeting him and really getting a chance to speak with him gave me an even greater dimension in terms of how this journey works for black composers, because there aren't a lot of black composers in Hollywood. Hearing his story, too, as a black composer and coming into the industry and succeeding as he has was also very personal inspiration to me.
Start looking for Cargyle's name in the end credits. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And lastly, some news from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Fans of Tom Holland's incarnation of Spider-Man suffered a summer heartbreak That's when Disney, which owns Marvel, and Sony, which controls Spider-Man, couldn't agree on how to share profits on the character moving forward. But the two studios signed a deal last night allowing Holland to appear in future Marvel films with Disney and Sony back together. The next Spider-Man film is due in theaters in the summer of 2021. And that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by the great team of Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, Julia Paskin, and Itzi Quintanilla. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. And our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. And the engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. Thank you.